From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition, we listen back to an interview with Mario Puzo, who died of heart failure 1 week ago. Puzo not only wrote the novel, The Godfather, and co-wrote the Godfather screenplays, he was the first to use the word to describe the head of a mafia family. Also, the new season of HBO's prison series Oz begins next week. We'll hear from actor J.K. Simmons, who plays the neo-Nazi. And John Powers reviews two new French films about love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Three current and former executives of food processing giant Archer Daniels Midland Company were convicted today in a price-fixing scheme. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Jody Becker reports.
Michael Andreas, the executive vice president of ADM, and Terrence Wilson, the retired head of its corn division, were sentenced today along with Mark Whitaker, another executive who acted as the FBI's undercover informant. Andreas and Wilson were sentenced to 2 years in federal prison and fined $350,000 each. Whitaker is already serving 9 years at a federal prison camp in South Carolina for swindling ADM out of $9 million. In September of 1998, the three top ADM executives were convicted of conspiring to fix the $600 million world market in lysine, a soybean-based additive that promotes growth in hogs and poultry. It was Whitaker who inadvertently launched the FBI investigation of the Decatur, Illinois-based food processing giant by claiming Japanese rivals were sabotaging ADM's move into the lysine market. For NPR News, I'm Jody Becker in Chicago.
In one of the biggest product liability wars in U.S. history, a jury in Los Angeles has awarded General Motors to pay, ordered them to pay $4.9 billion to six people. They suffered severe burns when the fuel tank of their GM car exploded during a rear-end collision. Their lawyers claim a GM document showed the company knew the gas tanks weren't safe but didn't want to pay for a recall. GM says it will appeal. Defense Secretary William Cohen says the United States will oppose granting political asylum anywhere in the world to Slobodan Milosevic. That declaration comes as Serbian opposition groups continue protesting against their leader. His opponents want Milosevic to resign following the NATO air campaign. NPR Steve Inskeep reports from the Pentagon.
The U.S. believes that some Serbs would like to find some other country where Milosevic could live in exile. That might make it easier to get rid of him. A few countries might be willing. The former Soviet Republic of Belarus has close ties to Yugoslavia, and so does the perennial U.S. enemy, Iraq. But Milosevic is an indicted war criminal. Almost any country in the world faces an obligation to arrest him if he turns up. And Defense Secretary William Cohen believes it should stay that way. Speaking in Denmark as he visits NATO allies, Cohen says Milosevic should not be safe anywhere, except maybe a courtroom in The Hague. That's where Milosevic would face trial if Western authorities ever found a way to arrest him. For now, this is all hypothetical. The Serb leader remains in power in Belgrade and shows no sign of going anywhere. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Amtrak officials said today the railroad Sunset Limited collided with a tractor-trailer rig yesterday after the truck's driver apparently ran a stop sign. 20 passengers and an engineer were taken to the hospital. Four remained there overnight. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at a record high today, 11,193. You're listening to National Public Radio News. A bipartisan panel headed by former CIA Director John Deutsch concludes that the United States is woefully unprepared for modern threats of nuclear, chemical, or biological attack. NPR's Korva Coleman reports.
Deutsch says the threat is far more serious than people think, and he warns a government response would be disorganized. There's increasing worry such an incident could occur. For example, terrorists could release anthrax or nerve gas on a major subway, like the nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway. Or another country could threaten the United States with nuclear weapons lost or stolen from the former Soviet Union stockpile. The Deutsch Committee report will be released officially next week. Panelists recommend the appointment of a new White House czar who could direct a focused defense against threats. The report also comes as North Korea hints it could test launch another long-range missile, which might be able to reach the West Coast. Russian attack jets had flown within striking distance of the East Coast, and a border war erupted between two new nuclear powers, India and Pakistan. Korva Coleman, NPR News, Washington.
Kathleen Celaya is going back to Los Angeles to face charges she planted pipe bombs under two police cars as a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Celaya had spent the last 24 years as a fugitive and had been living under another name with a husband and children in Minnesota. She confirmed who she really is and agreed today to be extradited. She'll be sent back next week to L.A., where she faces conspiracy charges. National Zoo officials are cautiously optimistic they'll be able to lease a pair of giant pandas from China. Zoo officials are offering $2.5 million over 10 years and would work with the Chinese on educational and research projects. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're going to listen back to an interview with Mario Puzo. He died of heart failure 1 week ago at the age of 78. Puzo wrote the novel The Godfather and co-wrote all three Godfather screenplays.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
I ask you for justice.
How much shall I pay you?
Buonasera. Buonasera. What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Be my friend? Godfather?
Good. Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
Puzo and Francis Ford Coppola won Academy Awards for their Godfather screenplay. Puzo's novel, The Godfather, sold about 21 million copies. I spoke with Mario Puzo in 1996, after the publication of his novel, The Last Don, about a mafia family that tries to go legit and branches out into Vegas casinos and Hollywood studios. Puzo wrote so convincingly about the mafia, people always assumed he had some inside connection, which he denied. I asked him how the mafia became the theme of so much of his work.
It started off my second novel, The Fortunate Pilgrim, where a minor character was a mafia leader. And everybody said, gee, you should have had more of that character. And really, all it is telling stories I heard in my childhood, you know, about people in the neighborhood and all that stuff.
What neighborhood was it?
Hell's Kitchen in New York.
Now, isn't that primarily an Irish neighborhood?
It was, then it became Italian. So when I was growing up, it was primarily Italian with a good mixture of Irish and who started off as enemies and then intermarried a great deal.
So who'd you hear the stories from?
Oh, members of my family, you know, like the rug stealing scene and the keeping of the guns from the police, you know, that kind of stuff that happened in the family.
Oh, well, tell the story the way it was told to you.
Well, my brother, who's older than me, this guy threw his guns over the airway, you know, the space between apartments. And my mother took them and held them for him. And then he came and got back his guns, and he said, would you like a rug? So she sent my brother over to get the rug. And my brother didn't realize the guy was stealing the rug until he took out the gun when the cop came. So that's almost entirely in the book and in the movie, you know. And there's little stuff like that.
Now, how did your mother feel about protecting this guy's guns?
Oh, in those days, this is when I was a very little kid, that was thought of as nothing. You know, that was like he was a neighbor and he wanted you to do it, and you did it because you were afraid of him, because you hoped, you know, that he would help you out.
Do you think your mother looked at the mob figures in your neighborhood as people who could protect your family, or as people who were more likely to harm your family?
No, protect. Because, for instance, the business about the dog being permitted to stay in the apartment, that happened to my family. My mother didn't want to get rid of the dog, so she went to the local guy of respect. I don't even think they thought of them as criminals. There were people who had influence, the way you would go down to your congressman, for instance.
So tell the dog story.
No, as it happened in the movie, the landlord wanted my mother to get rid of the dog, and she didn't want to get rid of the dog. He was going to kick her out, and the local whatever he was, I never really understood what he was, he told the landlord not to do it, and the landlord didn't do it.
Did she owe anything in return?
No, it was she was the cousin or the niece of somebody who knew the mafia guy, you know, one of those very family things, you know, a family courtesy.
Did she do anything to pay respect to the local organized crime figures who in part controlled the neighborhood?
Well, you have to remember that those figures are usually related by blood, you know, and were members of a family, so you gave them presents. If you had a family member who was powerful, you made sure that you gave him a present at Christmas, you know, or a special occasion, which was not regarded as a payoff in any way. It was, for instance, my parents grew up in Italy, where since they were mostly illiterate, when they had a letter that had to be read, they would go to the local priest to have the priest read it for them, but they would automatically bring a gift. They'd bring three or four eggs or, you know, chicken or something like that. It's a whole different relationship. It wasn't a bribe. It's a mark of respect. It's not like they said, you got to give me a piece of chicken or you got to give me an egg and I'll read it for you. It was just understood in the same way the local neighborhood guys that had influence, you gave them presents.
Describe Don Corleone the way you first envisioned him.
He was sort of very much like you had a brother who was much older than you, who would always protect you, you know, who would always stick up for you. He was somebody who was a protector.
I'm wondering if the character of Don Corleone was changed in your mind when Marlon Brando was cast in the film and you saw Marlon Brando inhabit the character.
No, I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando?
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter, and he called me up, and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him, and they refused. And then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Copeland. He managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role. But it was my idea to cast Brando, which caused me a lot of trouble before it finally got done.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me. They're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much, and Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play the Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Why were they so opposed to the idea?
Well, because Brando had built up what to them was a terrible reputation of being a troublemaker, you know, on his Mutiny on a Bounty, we cost them a lot of money, and you know, he was always a rebel. So they didn't want him in their movies. He was too much of a headache, and his movies had been flops.
Did he cause any trouble for you on the set?
No, well, I was never on the set, but they tell me it was perfect. You know, every actor just loved the idea of working with Brando. He's their idol, so... And when he came on the picture, he caused no trouble for the director, he caused no trouble for the actors. He was, they really liked him.
What were some of the battles that you and Francis Ford Coppola had to fight with the studio?
Well, over Al Pacino, at first I was for Al Pacino, then when he tested so terribly, I was against him. And then Francis talked me around into being for him again, you know? Because I had given Francis a letter saying I wanted Pacino, and after I saw him test, I told Francis, give me my letter back. And he says, no, wait, you wouldn't give me the letter back.
What was so bad about the test?
Francis knew what was wrong with him. He said he was very insecure, and it was sort of like his way of saying, you know, the hell with you guys. I don't have to test for you guys, I think. Because Pacino, who I got to know a little bit, is really like the most dedicated actor, the most dedicated work person that I've ever met in the movies.
Now, what were some of the most difficult parts of adapting the novel into the screenplay?
You mean the first one?
Yeah, the novel one? Of The Godfather.
It was a cinch.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was a cinch because it was the first time I'd ever written a screenplay, so I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and it came out right. And the story I tell is that after I had won 2 Academy Awards, you know, for the first 2 Godfathers, I went out and bought a book on screenwriting because I figured I'd better learn, you know, what it's about, because it was sort of off the top of my head. And then the first chapter of the book said, study Godfather 1 as the model of a screenplay. So I was stuck with the book.
I'm wondering, with the dialogue, everything is so... I mean, not everything, but the characters who really have power are very euphemistic in their language. So they could be saying... They could be giving you the message that they're going to kill you unless you follow their orders, but they'll be saying it in the nicest way. And, of course, killing would never be mentioned. Everything's kind of beneath, you know, between the lines, beneath the surface. What made you write the dialogue for these powerful... people in that coded way.
Well, it does come from the way the Sicilian mafia operated. In fact, there was a funny story that an Englishman came to live in Sicily, and he got a kidnapping note, because they like to collect the money for kidnapping you before they kidnap you, so they didn't have to go to the bother of kidnapping you. That was the way they operated. But the Sicilian mafia wrote this Englishman such a flowery note that he really didn't understand what they were saying. He had to get an interpreter in. He thought they were paying him some sort of compliment. He didn't realize they wanted like 50 grand off him before they kidnapped him, so to save everybody the trouble of going through the kidnapping. But it was very flowery. Your Eminence, we love you, you know, we'll do anything. If you have any trouble, give us a call, you know. And meanwhile... Just send us 50 grand and you'll never have any trouble with anybody. But that's how they talk. That's where I got it from. You know, that. And that horse's head thing was strictly from Sicilian folklore. They nailed the head of your favorite dog to your door as the first warning if you didn't pay the money. They were great believers in collecting money before doing the job.
One of the most famous lines that you came up with was about making an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah.
Does that line have its roots in mob lore that you knew, or did
I made it up. I wrote memos on how we could plant that line because I was sure it would become a famous line. You know, I recognized the fact it would become one of those lines that people would always be using. So that was really sort of carefully constructed, you know.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract with a big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson. And my father went to see this band leader. And he offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, My father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
How'd he do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. That's a true story.
We'll continue our 1996 interview with Mario Puzo after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Mario Puzo, the author of the novel The Godfather, co-author of the three Godfather screenplays. Puzo died 1 week ago of heart failure at the age of 78. Did you come up with the expression Godfather?
Yeah. And that was really an accident. Because before I used that, no mafia man ever used the word Godfather in that sense. Nobody used it. And I got it from an Italian family culture. The friend of your parents, when you're a little kid, your parents have very close friends, you call them godfather and godmother, the way in the American culture you call family friends aunt and uncle, even though they're not your aunt and uncle. You know, if they're a close family friend,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you're a kid, you say that's auntie or uncle so-and-so. So that was just the only way in which it was used, except this, in the religious sense. So I remembered it, and the more I used it during the book, the more it became, you know, what it was.
Do you think
so? So now the mafia uses it, everybody uses it, you know, and the word didn't exist.
Now, how did you become a reader and a writer? You've said that your parents were nearly illiterate.
They were illiterate, yeah. And because of the public libraries and the Settlement House Library, Hudson Gill Settlement House Library, and you started to read, and it was just the greatest thing in the world to read, that's all.
What did your parents think of you reading? It was something that they couldn't do. Were they proud of you for being able to do it?
No. I wrote a line someplace where my mother regarded my library card with the same horror that present-day mothers look at their son's heroin needles. You know, I made some sort of comparison to that. Reading was not relevant. Reading didn't help you make a living, you know?
Wrong.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So what did they think you should be doing? What did your mother think you should be doing instead?
Oh, you know, good clerical job on the inside. If you could avoid hard labor, that was the big thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what your mother was thinking, that you couldn't make money as a writer, I think that was true of your first couple of books.
It was very true, yeah.
Did you figure that would always be the case, that you were never really going to make money
writing? I always thought I would become rich and famous and be a great writer. I always believed that until, let's see, when I stopped believing that. I stopped believing that after I wrote The Godfather. I'm only kidding. I think you get less confident as you become more successful. Before I was successful, I was very arrogant as a writer. You know, I wouldn't listen to anybody.
And after you became successful, you lost faith?
I was very shaky.
Could you explain that phenomenon?
Oh, I think it's easy to be arrogant when you're unsuccessful because you have nothing to lose. And, you know, I know I used to brag a lot more when I was unsuccessful than I do now. I do my share of bragging now, but before I was successful, I was really terrible.
How have you reacted to criticisms from Italians, for instance, that in American popular culture, Italians are always shown as mob figures, and criticisms from people who say that the Godfather movies were just really violent and, you know, up the amount of violence in American popular culture?
Yeah, well, it sounds like some of my relatives, but but to me, it's a completely irrelevant thing. For one thing, there was a time when Italians ran crime in America, so I'm not maligning them in any way. In fact, I present them as very lovable people, you know, that have to make a living, unfortunately, in a way that society doesn't approve. But also, I know that most Italians that I grew up with were so law-abiding, they, you know, that getting a traffic ticket was terrible, you know? You know, for the working-class Italian people.
Your novel and the Godfather movies have had such an impact on American popular culture. And I'm wondering what you think it is about the stories that enabled them to have the impact that they had.
Well, I think it's a story with warm personal family feeling. And I think also it's everybody's wish, I mean, that they would have somebody they could go to who would correct all their injustices without the problems of going to court, hiring a lawyer, you know, somebody fixing up your world for you.
And if you cross them, you'd be dead.
But that's okay, because why would you want to cross them if they, you know, did everything for you?
Of course, everybody does end up crossing. I mean, everybody, and there's always a bloodbath.
So, people are not perfect.
Yeah. Mario Puzo, recorded in 1996. He died of heart failure 1 week ago at the age of 78. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, HBO's prison series Oz begins its third season next week. We'll feature an interview with actor J.K. Simmons, who returns as neo-Nazi Vern Schillinger. And film critic John Powers reviews two new French films about love. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO prison series Oz begins its third season next Wednesday. Oz is short for Oswald Maximum Security Penitentiary, the fictional prison in which the series is set. The program is about the lives of prisoners and correctional officers in the experimental unit of Oz, known as Emerald City. Most of the prisoners in Emerald City are violent, sadistic, and psychologically damaged. A good example is the neo-Nazi Vern Schillinger, played by my guest J.K. Simmons. Early in the first season of Oz, the neo-Nazi psychologically tormented his new cellmate, a young lawyer, and turned him into a sex slave. In this scene, Schillinger, the neo-Nazi, has stolen his cellmate's family photos and is using these photos to further intimidate the scared newcomer.
You've got a lovely family. I'm amazed you haven't showed me these pictures before. Amazed and a little hurt. I hope you don't mind me finding these hidden underneath your mattress. Beautiful. My wife is dead. But I've got two sons. 17 and 16. Handsome f-ing kids, too. Good Aryan stock, you know? My sons are devoted to me. I am an icon to them because I went to prison for my beliefs. They would do anything I asked them to. Steal, maim, kill. Maybe I should have them go visit your family. Huh? Just a little friendly call? What do you think? My sons and your wife. My sons and your daughter.
J.K. Simmons' chilling portrayal of the white supremacist is so good, yet we had never noticed him before, and very little has been written about him, so we invited him to Fresh Air. On this archive edition, let's listen back to the interview we recorded 1 year ago. J.K. Simmons, let me ask you to describe your character of Vern Schillinger on Oz.
He's the leader of the Aryan Brotherhood and in the maximum security prison, which is, of course, a neo-Nazi organization. He's a prisoner in for longer and longer, as it turns out. And one of the main relationships I have is with another prisoner, and he and I have sort of gone back and forth in this dominant, submissive, torturous relationship.
Yes, well, early on, when this other character whom you refer, who's a lawyer who was imprisoned for drunken driving, in which he accidentally murdered a child. Anyways, you made him your sex slave early in
Oz. I did indeed. I made him my lovely wife.
Yeah, I'm wondering what it was like for you to play this sadistic neo-Nazi who takes this young lawyer, makes him his sex slave.
Oh, it was pretty fun. You know, it really actually is just as bizarre and twisted and sick as much of what we do on the show is, and of course as much of what happens in a maximum security prison actually is. It's sort of like that, you know, like a MASH unit. We really have a great time, and we keep referring to the jokes and, you know, oh, and this joke is, you know, really going to work, where I tattoo his rear end. That'll be, you know, funny, because
with a swastika, I might add.
Yeah, with a swastika, sort of, you know, leaving my mark. It really is just a good time. It's a bunch of really wonderful actors working with Tom Fontana's words, and we're all just so happy to be there that that no matter how dark the stuff is that we're doing, it's just I guess it's kind of a release in a way, getting that stuff out in a safe way, and we just have fun.
I thought one of the high points of the first season was when your character, the neo-Nazi, got your sex slave to perform at, I guess it was the talent show or something, with lipstick on, singing "I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good."
Yeah, we were actually originally, Tom wanted that to be Somewhere Over the Rainbow, but for some reason they didn't want to give him the rights. So and I was all prepared with my, I don't think we're in Kansas.
It was a little Oz joke, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I was all prepared with my "I don't think we're in Kansas anymore" ad lib, and then they had to change it. But "I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good" was, you know, a pretty good second choice, and Lee pulled it off pretty well.
Who chose the song?
Tom Fontana, our erstwhile leader.
Now, what did you bring to the character in terms of research? Did you feel like you had to hang out with brothers of the Aryan Nation or go to prison and see what life was like inside? Did any of that seem necessary to you?
No, frankly, and it's also not as available to us working schmucks as it would be if I were Robert De Niro. It's not like I could just call the prison and say, hey, I'm J.K. Simmons. I want to come live with the prisoners for a few days. But I did do, I actually did, the research that I did do was mostly on the net, checking out some Aryan websites and just getting, trying to get an idea of their philosophy and how they state it so that I could have some kind of place to come from. And that was one of the things that Tom and I talked about between the first and second seasons was trying to get more into a little bit of the politics and relating my character with some of the other characters in the Black Muslim and some of the other characters in the show.
Now, the way you play the character of the neo-Nazi on Oz, there's always this veneer of solicitousness. You always make it seem as if what you're doing is for everybody's larger good, and you're a
veneer.
Real understanding kind of guy.
Vern's a sweetheart.
Well, that's how he sees himself. That's how he projects himself as he's, doing some very sadistic thing to you.
Yeah, my general philosophy of playing bad guys, which I've sort of done, half the time, is, very few people who we view as bad guys get out of bed and think, what evil, terrible thing am I going to do today? Most people see their motivations as justified, as, justifying whatever they do. And that's what I try to go with.
My guest is J.K. Simmons, and he plays the neo-Nazi Vern Schillinger in the HBO prison series Oz, and it's set in a maximum security prison in the experimental wing. Do you work out either just for your own fitness or for the fitness of the characters you play?
That's a good question. I weigh 47 pounds less right now than I did when Vern Schillinger was butt naked in the solitary confinement cell. I really had always taken pretty decent care of myself and been in, been an athlete and been in pretty good shape. And just the last few years, I think, as a combination of being in my 40s and being, reasonably comfortable and being able to eat whatever I wanted, I put on a lot of weight. And when I started playing Vern, a very tough, intimidating character. The first season as I watched the show, I just found myself thinking, who is the fat guy trying to act tough? And that was really part of my motive. I mean, that along with, wanting to be healthy and be able to continue playing softball and be an athlete and, live a long life and all that. I've really, in the last year, gotten very healthy again, and I get my butt to the gym every morning and eat more of the good stuff and less of the bad stuff and all that. And actually, during the course of the second season of Oz, during the 12 or 14 weeks that we shot, you'll see Vern drop some weight between the first and the eighth episodes, and then I've dropped most of the rest of the excess in the meantime. So I'm campaigning for Tom to write me another nude scene next season, so we can see, Vern must have been in the hole for a long time because he lost some weight.
Yeah, you and all the characters, after they're thrown in solitary naked, look so vulnerable. And it's,
believe me, I felt very vulnerable.
It's interesting, because you're such an intimidating character, and then, there you are stripped naked, lying on the floor of a dark cell.
Right.
In a fetal position, looking very vulnerable.
Yeah, that was also at a time. I mean, I think there are, if I had been thrown into the hole at other times, it would have been less vulnerable and more angry. But, that was also a time when I had just been thoroughly beaten, figuratively, by Lee Tergesen's character, you know, and so I was vulnerable on a number of fronts. My power had really been pretty much yanked away.
My guest is J.K. Simmons, and he's now co-starring in Oz, the prison series on HBO. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is J.K. Simmons. He plays the neo-Nazi inmate Vern Schillinger on the HBO prison series Oz. Oz was the first time I actually noticed you. I actually realized, well, who is this guy? He's really great. Let me find out more about him. And I'm wondering, where were you before that?
At the Big Fork Summer Playhouse in Big Fork, Montana, doing musical theater. Which is where I started out in, when I was in college in the 70s in Montana. And I bounced around doing regional theater all over the country for a lot of years. And when I finally got things going in New York, it was all on stage also. I did several Broadway shows. And really just 3 or 4 years ago started doing television and film and things that people might actually recognize me from.
Now, why did it take so long for you to break into television and film?
Because I was, at first, when I started doing this, I just thought it would be kind of a fun thing to do. I never had any intention of coming to New York or L.A. and actually doing more than scraping by, you know, doing plays. And as my career sort of progressed of its own volition, I did come to New York, I did Broadway shows, and I started realizing that this is actually how I'm going to make my living, so maybe I should try and do television and film and make a better living and get an occasional residual check so I can pay a mortgage someday. And, you know, I went shopping around for agents who I thought could help me more with those kinds of jobs. And I ended up in a big hit Broadway show, the revival of Guys and Dolls, a few years ago, which... all of us in that show ended up getting a lot of attention, and that helped sort of launch other aspects of our careers.
Now, I saw that revival on Broadway, and I guess I saw you and didn't realize it at the time because I hadn't yet seen you in Oz.
I played Benny South Street,
so you
Nathan's right-hand guy.
So you get to sing in the oldest established permanent floating crap game in New York.
Mm-hmm. And I sang the title song, Guys and Dolls, with Walter Bobby, and I sang the Fugue for Tin Horns. I got the horns right here. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, it was a great job. It was a great, fun show.
I think we should hear you sing. So why don't we play something from the cast recording of the recent Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls.
Oh, good. I thought you were going to make me sing live, and I didn't warm up.
So let's see. You've said you're on Fugue for Tin Horns. Why don't we play the part that you sing on the song, or one of the parts that you sing?
I'm making Valentine, because on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9. But look at Evan's happy with it by a half, according to this here is a telegraph.
But Paul Revere out bite, I hear his foot's all right. Of course, it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, the morning marks look fine. Besides the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
And just a minute, boys, I got the phoenix noise. It's like his great-grandfather was terrible poised.
I tell you, Paul. Now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I go for Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
So make it epic happy with his by a half, according to this here is a telegraph. Epitaph
Valentine,
Paul Revere,
I got the horse.
What a great score.
Yeah.
So have you sung a lot on stage?
Yeah, I actually, I was a musician in college, a composer and singer, and really intended to be the second coming of Leonard Bernstein when I got out, but I sort of segued into doing musicals and then into all aspects of theater and then into a maximum security prison.
A natural progression.
Sure.
Now, it's interesting, while you're getting known as the neo-Nazi on Oz, your brother David Simmons is becoming known as a Christian performer.
He is indeed.
It's an interesting contrast.
We're really not that different.
So how is he doing in his career in Christian music?
He's doing great. He has a CD out. The CD is called UBU, as in the letters UBU. And he has a website and everything, UBU Music, and it's a great CD. It has all original songs that David wrote the music and lyrics and did most of the playing for, and I don't see him enough. And David, I love you, man. He listens to NPR.
Is there anyone among your friends and family who you would rather not have see you on Oz?
Well, the ones that I would rather not have see me on Oz choose not to watch Oz anyway. Most of my dad's family in rural Illinois, would completely disapprove not only of the content, but some of the language. And I certainly respect that. And, they see me in my more G-rated kinds of things. And I was actually, during the first season especially, where I guess I was, as my wife said, bringing it home with me, she found it difficult to watch. I think she said something like it was airing at 11 o'clock at the time, and she was doing a Broadway show. So she would get home just before the show would be on, and after the second episode, she said, "So I'm supposed to come home from work, watch this with you, and then get into bed with you? I don't think so." So she actually kind of stopped watching during the first season, but she is watching it with me again now.
Can I ask what your brother, the Christian musician, thinks of your role as the neo-Nazi and of the kind of language you have to use on the show and the kind of extreme circumstances your character is in?
He thinks it's a reflection of the reality of prison life and the world today. And I don't think that he's got his 7-year-old staying up to watch it, nor do I think anyone should. David and I really come from, obviously we grew up together, but the same background even professionally. You know, he started out doing theater. We did musicals together at the Big Fork Summer Playhouse in, the 70s. And despite him being 4 years younger, he played my father and my father-in-law because he was slightly portly at the time and could grow a good beard. These are just the divergent paths that our careers have taken. We are ultimately not that different, and certainly philosophically and politically and spiritually and all of that, we're much more in accord than you might think based on the work you see us do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
J.K. Simmons plays neo-Nazi Vern Schillinger on the HBO prison series Oz. Oz begins its third season next Wednesday. Our interview with Simmons was recorded last July.
Never treats me sweet and gentle the way she should. I got it bad, and that ain't good. My poor heart. sentimental, not made of wood. I got it bad, and that ain't good. When the weekend's over, Monday rolls around, I end up like I start out, crying my heart out, Lord above me.
That's Mel Torme. Coming up, John Powers reviews two new French films. This is Fresh Air. Two new French films have come to the U.S. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
The Argentine writer Borges once said that art is a mix of algebra and fire. Of course, sometimes there's more fire and sometimes more algebra, which is one way of describing the difference between two new French movies about love, one by an enfant terrible, the other an old master. Few films burn more wantonly than Léos Carax's The Lovers on the Bridge, which, for financial reasons, has taken 8 years to reach the States. In that time, this visionary portrait of l'amour fou has come to be recognized as one of the decade's most thrilling films. The movie stars the pre-Oscar Juliette Binoche as Michelle, a young artist with a degenerative eye disease who's estranged from her middle-class home. She gets caught up in an obsessive passion with Alex, a young tramp played by Denis Levant, whose skills include fire-breathing and theft. They live together on the Pont Neuf, the oldest bridge in Paris, which has been closed for repairs. This landmark unites the two banks of the river, and Carax uses it as a metaphor for the brutal modern city, whose famed lights twinkle opulently around those forced to sleep on the street, and as a magical domain where unhoped-for dreams can come true. This is a movie that feels like a dream. There may be no more magical scene in contemporary movies than Carax's evocation of the 1989 bicentennial celebration, when Alex and Michelle dance on the bridge while fireworks bloom in the darkness around them, and Michelle risks her life water skiing on the Seine. Carax made The Lovers on the Bridge in his late 20s, and it's bursting with a young man's excesses. It cost $28 million, back when the average French film cost 1/40th of that. I won't deny that Carax's flamboyant male fantasies can become too much. There are moments when I wanted to smack some sense into him. But his extravagance is forgivable in a movie that's all about the too muchness of living in the moment. Reckless love, irredeemable loss, harrowing public cruelty, and beauty so fierce that it tears at your heart. From its late-night tour of the Louvre to Alex and Michelle's final plunge into the river, this is movie-making at its most staggeringly romantic. After such a starburst of youthful passion, there's something soothing about Autumn Tale, made by Eric Rohmer, who's famous for films like My Night at Maud's and Pauline at the Beach. Rohmer has spent his career charting the charms and delusions of love. And now, at age 79, he looks at the subject with the cool wisdom of a sage. In Autumn Tale, he sets aside his usual preoccupations with young people to explore the romantic yearnings of middle age. Béatrice Rahmán plays Magali, a feisty 45-year-old wine grower who's been without a man since her husband's death. She becomes the target of a double machination. Her best friend, played by Marie Riviere, schemes to set her up with an amiable businessman. Meanwhile, her son's girlfriend plans to pair her off with a professor who has one distinct flaw. He's into young women. Magali wanders through the labyrinth of these intrigues in search of an autumnal love. Romer has an aristocratic fondness for delicacy, and if he lived forever, he'd never make a movie with all the Sturm und Drang of the lovers on the bridge. Autumn Tale has been constructed as neatly as a mathematical proof, but it doesn't feel pinched like some of his work. The story is suffused with a new warmth and tenderness, as if Romer, that great anatomist of human self-deception, can't stop himself from rooting for his characters to find happiness before it's too late. This is a film alive with sophisticated pleasures. Sly dialogue, exquisite lighting, enthralling actresses, and the glorious Rhone Valley. And it's bracingly affirmative. Romer doesn't see true love as a flame that must consume us, but as an unexpected visitor who can arrive at any time in our lives if we're willing to hear the knock.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sharrock. Bob Purdick is our engineer. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from a new CD of duets featuring guitarists Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. They'll be our guests next Wednesday on Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Neurotica by Sue Margolis, a debut novel about a reporter who will do anything for a good story. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Both sides in the Microsoft antitrust case are preparing their closing arguments. On the next Fresh Air, we review the trial and its business and consumer implications with Joseph Nocera, who's been covering the story for Fortune magazine. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.